and we have to really escalate the noise we make so that we'll be heard.
Welcome to Gay USA. I'm Andy Hopp.
I'm Ann Northrup, and there seems to be a crowd of people here with us.
Happy New Year, everybody. Hope you had a good holiday. We are excited to do a year-in-review show with three of our favorite activists. We have with us today to talk about this 2020 and project into 2021. Jillian Weiss, who is an LGBTQ discrimination attorney and the author with David Cruz of Gender Identity and the Law, and a transgender activist. Jackie Rudin, who has been an activist since the late 1960s, part of Reclaim Pride, one of the founders of Rise and Resist and the Queer Liberation March, and used to be a chronicler of the downtown art and performance scene, I guess still is. And J.W. Walker, whose primary identification is the RBG Army, a founding member of Gays Against Guns, the Reclaim Pride Coalition, and the Queer Liberation March, among other groups, including Rise and Resist. Welcome, everybody.
Hi, Andy.
And I do want to say, because we are going to talk about this year, and it's been a hard year for all of us, but we had some, and we're going to talk more about this in detail, but there were two big things we accomplished this year. The defeat of Donald Trump and the Supreme Court decision that equated sexual orientation and gender identity discrimination with sex discrimination under the law. But we will get to those topics and all the other things that happened that weren't so good.
That, of course, is the Bostock decision, which is already reaping rewards, which Jillian will tell us more about. And Jay, I assume the RBG Army is the Ruth Bader Ginsburg Memorial Militia. But let's start the year not on such an up note, because it's just inescapable that we are still in the midst of this pandemic. And so I just want to go around the horn once to give you each a chance to tell us in a minute or two about your experience in the midst of this just unprecedented, well, not unprecedented, it's happened in history, but in our lifetime, this kind of global pandemic, and how your experience has been of illness, isolation, government inaction, all that kind of thing. Jillian, can we start with you?
Sure. Well, you know, I've been very fortunate, and those I know who and my family and friends have been very fortunate that no one has fallen ill from COVID. You know, when I first heard about this, I locked the door back in March and kind of didn't emerge since then. I did move during the pandemic, but it was a really a good move to a larger apartment with a home office. So I'm now able to work out of my home, and I have a tremendous amount of work to do. So that's been keeping me busy and out of trouble and, you know, stopped me from being depressed and so on. You know, I feel very fortunate. A lot of my clients are working in situations where they're not protected, and it's very difficult. Fortunately, none of them have become ill, but I'm concerned.
But the work is keeping your spirits up, or at least keeping you moving forward.
I love what I do so much. It gets me up every day. Okay. And I'm very fortunate in that respect.
Jay, what about you?
For me, I also have been fortunate. I've not been ill. My best friend and her husband were among some of the early infected, and they really had a very difficult time of it, you know, early on in March and in April. It took them a while to get it out of their systems. And really, you know, the work that the Reclaim Pride Coalition did against Samaritan's Purse and their field hospital in Central Park, their completely unnecessary field hospital in Central Park, you know, kind of got me through the early part of the pandemic. Then I lost my job. I was COVID laid off from the nonprofit that I worked at in late May. A few days later, after I was laid off, George Floyd was murdered. And so the whole period of activism in the wake of his and Breonna Taylor's and Ahmaud Arbery's deaths kind of sort of sustained me and gave me that sense of community that being on lockdown certainly didn't.
Okay, thank you. Jackie?
Yeah, I, like everyone else, I'm lucky in that I didn't get sick. I had a very dear friend did get sick and died very quickly, Jim Campbell, at the beginning of April. So I was, kind of taken down by that and had a really difficult time. He's a good friend of a bunch of us, a bunch of my friends. So we all had to deal with it, and it was really difficult because we had to go through actually going to his apartment, getting his body placed somewhere. His body wound up in one of those trucks outside of, 7th Avenue, the hospital, 7th Avenue and 13th Street, right down the block from Robert's house. It was a trauma for all of us, just seeing what you have to go through to die during COVID. And the inability to mourn him in any possible way, it was horrible. But, I stayed in. Most of my friends stayed in. I'm involved with Rise and Resist. And, Gays Against Guns, we all made a pledge to carry on with our meetings and stuff. And we did that with Zoom, and that was a lifesaver. But we're also a restless group. And we felt, there was so much going on in the streets and what was happening with whether it was George, it was before even George Floyd, but things were happening that we felt, really needed our attention. And we had to sit down and create a way to go back into the street somehow. And we did that early on. I'm not sure of the date of our first one, but we went to Washington. There was a point at which it was found out that, Trump knew how dangerous it was, but he wasn't saying anything because he didn't want the stock market to go down. And so we, Jane, just a few of us, we made it so that only six people could attend this action, so that each one could hold this banner and be 6 feet apart from each other. And there'd be two people that are two photographers like me and Donna Theo, and just very limited so that we'd no problem with spreading anything. And, I'm not going to die for Wall Street. We just had a couple of signs and we just had to make a statement, and we kept going out a few at a time, to these demonstrations. Being really, really careful, because we have a lot of people who are like myself, 70 years old and older, that are at risk just because of our age. People don't want to feel like, they look weak because they don't want to go into the street. There are all kinds of feelings around whether people go out or don't go out and how they feel about that. So we had to deal with that. Eventually we figured it out, but it got really challenging when the incident with George Floyd did happen, and when all the other uprisings started to happen, when all of a sudden it was no longer our seven or eight people, it was massive crowds. And to make a decision about whether to join that was really tricky and really hard, or to figure out how to do it. It was not whether, because we had to do it. And most people in Rise and Resist did go out, and all the other groups that I'm involved with. And, happily there were situations where people were masked, because there certainly wasn't a lot of social distancing going on. So, I went through that, and I went through my feelings about that, and knock on wood, I'm okay, and most of the people I know are okay, and we're trying very hard to figure, to navigate how to get through this and be out there.
Thank you. Andy?
Well, I'm 67 and overweight, and a woman in the building died right in March, a friend. So I took every precaution that I could. And I've been listening to you talk about actions and demonstrations. I have to say I shied away from a lot of them. I went to a couple, but not many. This show is kind of what got me through the year. Being able to do this via Zoom every week and the dialogue and have the structure to the week and something. So that helped an awful lot as far as I was concerned. But I, to my knowledge, I have not contracted COVID. I haven't been tested. And I'm surviving. And I hope you all are too.
And everyone else. I was tested, but a few months ago, just to make sure I had gotten through the initial phase, because I think, as several of you said, I think we have been lucky, because when this first hit, you just didn't know whether you had it or not. There was no way you could have prevented it at first. Either you had it or you didn't. So I confirm that I didn't at some point, but I haven't been tested since. I just have relied on not having any symptoms. And I've stayed at home a lot, but I've also gone out a fair amount, but trying to be safe, masked, distanced, whether it's grocery shopping or a few demonstrations like you, Andy. I've gone to some, but not a ton. I know that Jay and Jackie have been a lot more active in the streets. I'm mostly, I don't know whether to describe myself as angry or frustrated or whatever at this going on and on and on, in large part because of this horrible administration, which has not done anything about it. We now have a president who has abdicated all responsibility for the job, and the lies and the people who are not paying attention and doing things that could shorten all this. So I have a lot of, I'll just call it frustration about that. I'm eager to be free. I feel restricted, and I don't want to feel restricted. I want to feel that life is more casual and simple again. But there's, it's not like the world has stopped. There's a lot going on at the same time. So let's delve into more of what has happened in 2020. And I have to say that Bostock decision at the Supreme Court has got to be one of the most important things that has happened in this or any other year. So, Jillian, why don't you fill us in again about that? We've been talking about it all year, but remind people of what that was and how important it was and where we're going with that.
Sure. That was a consolidation of three different cases. The reference to Bostock was a reference to one of the plaintiffs. And essentially, in that decision, the Supreme Court looked at when someone is fired because they are gay or transgender, is that because of sex, so that it becomes sex discrimination under the law? And there were a lot of opinions about which way they were going to go. I have to say that I felt very comfortable that they were going to rule as they did, and I said so in many places, and even wrote a law review article on it in 2008, saying that they would do that. But okay, be that as it may, what happened here really was surprising. Justice Gorsuch, who is known as a fairly conservative justice, and he is well known also as part of the so-called textualists or originalists who scrutinize the meaning of each word and look in dictionaries and so on to try to figure out what things mean. They thought for sure he was going to look at a dictionary and say, well, it says that sex means, you know, biological something. So he would just say, no, sorry, it doesn't apply. But in fact, he did exactly the opposite. And the way that he did it was actually extremely interesting, was because he said, if you just think about it, you know, if you're going to fire someone because you don't like the sex of the person that they're dating, or you don't think that they're living up to, you know, the sex that you think they are, all of that involves sex. And that's what the word means. That's what the law says. And so let's just go with that. And, of course, the other conservatives were outraged. I think it was Justice Alito who referred to Justice Gorsuch as a pirate pretending to be an originalist. But anyway, so, you know, it was surprising to many people. And, you know, to many people that I know, it was a pleasant surprise. And it affects every law that refers to sex anywhere in the country, basically. You know, any law that says you can't discriminate based on sex, now you can't discriminate against gay or transgender or bisexual, lesbian people, you know, and non-binary queer people, anybody who kind of fits within that definition of sex discrimination. So it's, you know, it's a wonderful decision.
And we have had some subsequent decisions in lower courts that are playing off of this, that are citing it already, that are using this as a rationale for good decisions, correct?
Yes, that's absolutely correct. I mean, a number of courts, in a number of states, the courts have said, well, we're just going to follow whatever the federal decisions are. They have a state statute that says you can't discriminate based on sex. But, you know, they may not have a lot of cases. Maybe it's a small state. The issue doesn't come up that much. They say, well, just follow what the federal law says. And that's been bad for us for many years because the federal law didn't say that gay and trans and LGBTQ people are protected. But now it does. So the seesaw has, you know, swung completely to the other side. And now everybody who doesn't like that result is, you know, in a tumult and really not sure what to do.
And of course, we could solidify all this if we win the two Georgia races and the Democrats control the Senate and they can join the House in passing the Equality Act, which would be a federal LGBTQ rights bill. But yes, we'll see about that. In the meantime, things are kind of threatened. And the big threat from the courts and all these Trump judges is the whole religious freedom argument that, well, if I'm religious, I get an exemption from this. And that was the Philadelphia case that was heard by the Supreme Court. We'll likely hear about it in June. What do you all feel about the prospects of overcoming this kind of society drifting into religious people can do what they want and other people can't?
Well, Jillian, do you have a prediction on the Fulton versus City of Philadelphia case that is the Catholic adoption agency that wants to discriminate against same-sex couples?
I don't. It's really not my area. And, you know, I am concerned about it as anybody else, but I'm hopeful. A number of commentators said after the oral argument they felt hopeful that it would come out the right way. I think more generally this question of do people whose religions require them to discriminate against certain categories of people, does that, you know, trump the law? And I mean, I think that's a ridiculous proposition. You know, it certainly doesn't apply in terms of race or other kinds of things. I don't see why it should apply here.
In terms of people's religious, supposed religious values, you mean?
Yeah, with regard to LGBT people. In other words, even if you had a religious value that says I have to discriminate against people because they're black or Asian or white or whatever, you know, you couldn't get away with that. They would say, no, I'm sorry, the law is. But because we're specifically dealing with a group that's marginalized in the LGBT population, somehow people feel that, well, I guess that's fine then.
Well, you might be able to get away with it within your religion and believe whatever you want to believe. But these people are saying, and we want government money to do what we're doing, which is the real. I mean, come on. It sounds so unfair, and it is so unfair. If you want a government grant, you've got to serve everybody.
Well, and the other part of it is that you name me one religious group, one denomination, one sect, where someone who's a member of it is claiming that they have the right to discriminate against LGBTQ people. I can give you 10 other people that belong to that exact same sect, that exact same religion, that exact same denomination, who don't believe that. And therefore, if you've got two people that belong to the same faith group who have divergent views on the subject of LGBTQ people, then that is not a religious value. That is a personal value that someone is couching in the context of their religion, but it's obviously personal because someone else in the same religion believes the opposite.
But it's really the leadership of these religions who determine that. There are, you know, Catholics as a group are in support of birth control, are in support of reproductive rights, are in support of LGBTQ people, and yet their leadership stands in the way of those rights across the board. It's with politicians, too. The American people are overwhelmingly in favor of things like a higher minimum wage or this $2,000 payment to people or all sorts of progressive ideas. But their political leaders, the people they elect, for heaven's sakes, are standing in the way of all that. I find that just outrageously frustrating.
Well, 73 million people voted for Trump, and that was the most gobsmacking thing that happened this year. That's the second most votes anybody ever got for president in history. Thank goodness Joe Biden won. It's going to make a big difference.
With the most votes that anyone ever got in presidential election history.
over 80 million. So that's, I mean, that was my feeling about the election. On the one hand, relief, tremendous relief. People were screaming in the courtyard here all over the country. But there's this core in this country that wants authoritarianism.
So, Jackie, you've been out in the streets demonstrating against Trump a lot in the last 6 months. You're still wearing your Trump is over sweatshirt. I'm not giving up my anti-Trump Christmas ornament until he actually leaves office. What do you encounter in the streets? I mean, you're in New York, but do you run into Trump supporters around town?
We do. For the most part, you know, we're the majority, and we don't run into a lot of people that are on the opposite side. But we do have our, some of them they show up at almost everything we do because we put it on Facebook. And, you know, we're on a first name basis at this point. At the beginning, they were really, really hostile, and it was tremendously confrontational interactions that I used to have to pull Jay back by his sweatshirt, pull him back because he's really ready to just, you know, take on. You know, Alexis and Jamie have taught us so well about, you know, disengaging and not engaging in people that try to, you know, the pro-Trump people, but they can be exasperating and very much in your face and very argumentative. And they have a tactic where they draw you in and they get you to, you can't help but respond if you're a normal human being. And they have their cameras out, their phones out, so that they will have a video of you being hysterical back to them as opposed to their first, you know, so that you look like the horrible person. And it's a tactic that they use a lot. They come, you know, they try to videotape. But we've gotten really good at it. We know who they are. And actually, at this point, they know who we are. And we're not the ones that they're going after as much as they may be going elsewhere amongst their, you know, their own people. For the most part, we run into people who are very grateful. Grateful that we're out there. Grateful that somebody has the courage to be out in the street in this seriously dangerous environment and stand up for what we believe, which is also what they believe, and just so keep showing our resistance to Trump and to everything that's been going on. It's so hard because we're all so alone on a very big level, you know, in our homes, whether we're, you know, in communities or not. Ultimately, at the end of the day, if you're not with a family, married, with children, whatever, you're alone and you feel very isolated. So when people get a chance to see something that really means something to them, I mean, they're really grateful. And an actress to come over and tell you how grateful they are that they're not alone. You know, we're in a very difficult time right now. There's so much to be upset about. There has been, you know, now that the election, we're, you know, but I'm talking about before the election, this whole year has been so frustrating and so overwhelmingly horrible, you know? I mean, just it's insurmountable on many, many levels. So, we've found that a lot of people are very happy that we're out there. We find it to be the only way we can exist. I mean, getting out there is how we find our peace of mind and sanity, knowing that we're just not sitting here watching, you know, the news constantly bombarding us with more bad... all bad news.
You know? And you all did great work. And Trump will be gone, barring some extraordinary circumstance. And so what are you all looking forward to being different this year? And by the way, since we talked about it for the last couple of weeks, Governor Cuomo did sign that gender-neutral restroom bill in New York. We've got a single-serve restroom. It's got to be gender-neutral across the state. But what are people really looking forward to, the big changes that you expect to see sooner or later this coming year?
Well, one thing I'm looking forward to is the Trump administration had changed the Obama administration's rule at the Department of Health and Human Services that medical services may not be based on discrimination because of sex, including sexual orientation and gender identity. And the Trump administration got rid of that rule. It was a long process because there's all kind of procedural things you have to do and so on. But I understand that President-elect Biden is going to be nominating Xavier Becerra for the Secretary of Health and Human Services. So I know that he has a very good understanding of all these issues, and I'm hopeful that that will change.
And Ken, you know, Trump did make a lot of changes, wiping out non-discrimination rules across the board in education, in the military, in, you know, federal contracting. Are all those easily changed by the next administration?
Well, the military issue is before the courts right now, but I'm assuming that they could just go back to the previous rule. I'm sure there's different things they have to do, you know, to justify that. But my assumption is they can do that. And I think that we will see a lot of that. I mean, another example is the rule prohibiting discrimination by federal contractors. That was changed. And so, you know, that can go back into effect. I mean, it's not immediate. You can't just wave a wand and then tomorrow it's in place. But, you know, there's certain waiting periods and notices that are required and so on. But I think that they'll be able to change a lot of these things because they were not well thought out by the Trump administration. Thank goodness.
And are you confident that the people that Biden is talking about putting in and his administration in general have a decent understanding of these issues and will prioritize them?
You know, I haven't seen all of the people that have been named, but I've seen a number of them. They all, you know, were people that I thought had a good grasp. I mean, the fact that President-elect Biden is very clear on these issues is important. I mean, as a matter of fact, in his speech, he used the word transgender in his acceptance speech. And, you know, a lot of people were very, very happy about that. And he said a number of other things that made people happy. I think that he is the leader. And I think that Kamala Harris has a similar viewpoint. They will make sure that it goes in the right direction.
Just for our viewers or listeners who are wondering who are these people, since we have been chatting, that's Jillian Weiss, attorney, co-author of the forthcoming law school casebook, Gender Identity in the Law, and trans activist. We also have two New York activists with us, Jackie Rudin and J.W. Walker, co-founders with others of Rise and Resist, Gays Against Guns, RBG Army, Reclaim Pride. We used to say that we made up new groups every week just so people would think there was a bigger movement. But I think all these groups are substantial and real and active. Jay, can I just go back to you for a second? I can't lose this thread of Jackie pulling you away from confrontations. Can you just take a minute to tell us about those confrontations and the rage that arises and what all that is?
Well, the God's honest truth is, and as the atheist says, is that it's performative rage. It's not real rage. You know, I see these folks, you know, Juliet and Dion and what have you, that show up at our actions.
We are on a first name basis.
Oh yeah, we all know all of them. Yeah, you know, yeah, we know them by name. I mean, I'm not going out for drinks with them or anything, but we know who they are. They know my name. That, you know, I've literally had Juliet like call out to me as Rise and Resist is entering an area with our banner. You know, so it's, you know, there are times when I think a little performative rage at them is appropriate. It's not normally at those guys who we see all the time. It's normally at the sort of outliers that come and decide to sort of yell at us and get ugly. And sometimes I'll give them a little ugly back just for balance. But the one thing that I would add on, though, to you know, the situation of encountering these maggots out when we're doing actions out in the streets, is the sort of overwhelming support that the NYPD gives to them. It's a regular situation. They crowd around them, they protect them, they escort them to their cars, they never charge them when they do anything wrong, whereas if if a Black Lives Matter protester, you know, steps off of the sidewalk and into the street for a second, they run the risk of being tackled and brutalized and arrested and charged with all number of things. You know, and these Trump supporters, they get to sort of walk around with impunity. During one demo that was held by Nupol Kiazulo, after some protesters were attacked by police, Rise and Resist arrived at the action in support. Some of the Trump supporters were already there. They were then escorted by the police to their car. Then the police left them, and they promptly ran their car into the demonstrators. I mean, literally within, you know, 30 seconds of the police sort of closing the door in their car and tipping their hat to them and sending them on their way, they are literally running into a bunch of Black and brown, mostly trans protesters out there, you know, fighting for human rights. And so, you know, that is a serious issue that the NYPD has failed to address. We saw this recent report that was released, you know, delineating all of the ways in which the NYPD has run itself horrifically through this, you know, period of reckoning after George Floyd's murder. And the only response that we've gotten is a videotaped statement from de Blasio without him facing any questions from journalists about his behavior during this time, about the fact that he defended the NYPD up one side and down the other throughout the last 6 months, whenever any of these many, many, many cases of brutality, including at the Queer Liberation March, which some present here helped organize. Going back to the question about what I'm hopeful for with the Biden administration, to me, it's that we get back to some real action from the federal government dealing with local law enforcement. You know, we've known for 14 years, according to the FBI, and much longer, according to many. And the Brennan Center for Justice just issued a report about organized white supremacists actively infiltrating law enforcement at every level. It's been going on for decades in this country. Nothing has been done by anyone. So I'm really hopeful that whoever the attorney general that President-elect Biden picks for that post, we're still waiting, as far as I know, unless something's been revealed today.
I think he's waiting for the Georgia senators, because that's going to determine who we can get confirmed.
Who we can get confirmed?
Yeah.
So, you know, whoever that is, I'm really hopeful that they're going to really hone in and focus and sort of revisit some of the Justice Department activities that were happening under the Obama administration as far as investigating law enforcement and really looking at racial bias and racial profiling in law enforcement in localities where there seemed to be, you know, headlines or disparate treatment or what have you. That Trump eviscerated the entire program once the little possum, I can't remember what it was, Jeff Sessions, once Jeff Sessions had been installed as Attorney General. I'm really hopeful that that a President Biden, a Biden administration will get back to that.
Well, can I just say one thing about, you know, I'm really concerned about the locally what's going on with the police and our demonstrations right now, more than I am pro-Trump people. I'm horrified. I'm trying to remember what the reason for the last, this, we had a march that went downtown from, like, I think the library, maybe it was protected. I can't remember what it was now, but we went down.
Protect the results.
Huh?
It was protect the results.
We went down Fifth Avenue very peaceably, and a really large crowd, diverse crowd, but we went down to Washington Square Park, and then we circled the fountain, and we did whatever we were going to do, and then we had a distinct time to end. So, you know, we started out at like 5, we got there around 7, at 7:15 we, you know, the plan was to disperse, and we did. A bunch of us hadn't seen each other in a long time, so we kind of hung around the edges. I went out to dinner with, you know, a couple of friends, you know, falafel or whatever, and hung around that area. And I don't live that far away from there either. And what got me was that after dinner, probably 8:45 or so, I was walking home, and I saw all these, what are they called? The police with the bicycles and these very, you know, high-tech outfits now. I think they have special
turtles. Reasons.
What are they?
They call them the turtle shells or something, yeah.
So what, I mean, you know, I was passing them by, and, you know, it was just they were hopped up on pills or something. They were so intense and so threatening, and they were standing there, you know, like ready to pounce. About, I'd say, 75 or 100 of them right outside, you know, Larry Kramer's old building, you know, at 2 Fifth Avenue. They were all, like, on that corner waiting for something. And we, you know, we'd done our thing. We were the thing, I thought. And, you know, what were you all doing there? And, you know, oh, we're waiting for this, you know, other thing. And I realized, because I stuck around, you know, long enough to almost see what was about to happen, that they were waiting for, you know, there was a Black Lives Matter group happening in the park that they were ready to jump on, you know. And the way they go after, you know, Black people, people of color, trans, I mean, it's just so dangerous right now that, I don't know, you know, it's, and I blame de Blasio, you know, I blame, you know, the commissioner, and de Blasio was questioned about this particular incident because they did pounce on that next group and they did go after them and there were many arrests and there was a lot of violence.
Let's try to move this more nationally and globally. And you did mention Larry Kramer, who was one of the more notable deaths this year. But of course, we're also, I think, up to 44 trans and non-binary people murdered in this country, mostly trans women of color. And we talk about it almost every week on this show, these murders. But the question is, and I open it up to Jillian and everybody, what is going to be done to really turn this around? Because what trans activists say to me is, hey, you know, it's not just a matter of protecting us from violence. It's about education. It's about housing. It's about jobs, those kinds of things. Is that going to, in this atmosphere of austerity and all this kind of stuff, is that going to change?
Well, I mean, I think you have to remember that the way that society is structured has many, many effects on individuals. You know, little changes in the hierarchies, the law somewhere, it creates problems for people that, you know, they're not even aware that it comes from that. When you deprive people of educational opportunities, of employment opportunities, and housing opportunities, medical care, and so on, you place them in a precarious situation. And what we're seeing is the effect of that. You know, there have always been a high number or high proportion of trans people who are subject to violence. But the fact that it's increasing and that you're noting, you know, how many more now we're seeing on an annual basis simply shows that we have shifted our society to hurt the most marginalized people. And that is just the tip of the iceberg. There are many, many people who weren't killed and they're not necessarily in the newspaper, but they were injured or they lost their jobs or they're, you know, living in poverty conditions or in very marginal situations, involved in the shadow economy and subject to all kinds of problems. You know, that's really the issue that we need to address. It's not just the few people that we see that have been, you know, murdered. And of course, we should protest that and we should recognize that and remember that. But the issue really is, what are we doing for people every day?
And do you have we just spoke in generalities. Do you have a more a prescription or ways that individuals can help in this situation?
Well, I mean, that's a great question. For myself, I have determined that I think one of the most important things is employment opportunities. And so that's why I'm really working in that area of employment discrimination. I'm also doing some housing discrimination cases now, but it's mostly employment. Because when you can get a good job and support yourself and your family, you live a much different life than when you can't. And so, you know, if a lot of trans people who have been in these precarious situations could get jobs as investment bankers, I'm sure they would. But the opportunities aren't there. So, you know, for me, employment is number one. And I think that there are a lot of ways to help people who are having difficulty finding employment to, you know, kind of, you know, talk about them in your networks and, you know, try to find opportunities for them and things to do. I've employed a number of people. I mean, I have a very small law firm. It's not a major employer, and, you know, it's hopefully will the money will keep coming in. But, you know, I've employed a number of people and training them as paralegals. They don't have a tremendous amount of education or skill, but you don't have to be a rocket scientist to do this. You just have to know what to do and how to do it. And I've given them, you know, some employment on that score. And there's a lot of people who have a lot of resources who could, you know, give people some opportunities that maybe they haven't thought of. They haven't thought of themselves as giving people jobs, but maybe ought to.
Let's get Secretary of Transportation Pete Buttigieg, the first out gay Senate confirmed nominee, if he is confirmed, to the cabinet to set aside a lot of these infrastructure jobs for marginalized people, including transgender people. I'd like to, you know, so a lot of this, of course, is left up to the states. And, you know, we did have a breakthrough this year. Virginia became the first southern state to protect its citizens on the basis of sexual orientation and gender identity because they were able to flip the legislature there. But the election results were very disappointing in most of the states in terms of these kinds of things. So what do, I mean, on the other hand, in localities, even in towns and cities in Mississippi and Missouri, they're all passing laws banning conversion therapy and protecting rights on the basis of sexual orientation and gender identity. So what do we face on the local level, which is how this country operates?
I mean, I would think that the thing that we have to think about is not even so much about the local level in terms of elected officials, but on the community level. You know, when a part of the discussion during this reckoning for Black lives has been about the responsibility of white people to become anti-racists. I think that when we're talking about specifically and almost entirely Black trans women being killed in Black communities by straight identified cisgender Black men, there is a need to have these discussions within Black communities to do away with so much of this marginalization within the Black community. You know, it's the same, I guess, as it is across the board. You know, trans folks are the most marginalized people within each marginalized community of which they are a part. It's the last barrier to break in many ways. As a gay Black man, and with a large family on both sides, I haven't really ever experienced discrimination within my family for being gay. There are other gay people, there are gay kids, what have you. I do have a young trans nephew, and he's been accepted by the family, or not nephew, a cousin. But until we have churches involved, until we have civic groups involved, until we have conversations at barbershops within Black communities, this is going to keep happening. We can have rarefied conversations about electeds and what have you. It's at the community level that we're going to really, you know, possibly save lives. So I just wanted to throw that out. And we're going to have to deal with it in the broader LGBTQ community. The situation that is occurring with TERFs, with trans exclusionary radical feminists, with the J.K. Rowlings of the world. You know, we have to face that. We have to really push back against that, because that is going to help support more violence rising from, you know, from the street level.
And it was so great to see so many hundreds of women, athletes and connected to sports organizations, standing up in this court case in Idaho and saying trans girls are girls and should play girl sports.
Meanwhile, Tulsi Gabbard, who called herself a member of the LGBT caucus during her time in Congress, decides that her parting shot is going to be to attack trans women athletes as she leaves Congress. Madness.
Terrible.
Jay and Jackie, let me check in with you on something else you've been passionate about and involved in, and that's Gays Against Guns and the anti-gun violence movement. Something that I think we certainly all support, but I've been skeptical about how much progress we could make. Where do we stand with that? What's your work these days, and what do you foresee there?
Right now, the main focus that the GAG is really pressing in on is the interstate trafficking, the iron pipeline. That's what we've seen this over the course of the last 6 months in New York, this huge spike in gun violence, you know, brought on by all of the societal stresses and economic stresses and family stresses that are occurring under this pandemic, with all this uncertainty, with the horrible leadership. It's inevitable that we would have a rise in violent crime, right? Just, you know, we're going through hell. You know, that's of course going to happen. But of course, the presence of guns, the easy availability of guns is exacerbating that already tense and dire situation. And we know this for a fact.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I'm just going to say, we know for a fact that the guns that are used in 70% of the crimes in New York City come from out of state. And they come from states like Virginia, like North Carolina, like Ohio, that have lax gun laws, and they get bought at gun shows where there are no background checks, and they get put in trunks of cars or in the bellies of buses and trucked into New York, where they get sold on the street at a high markup from what they paid for them at those gun shows in Ohio or North Carolina or wherever. That's got to be for an urban area. That's got to be the focus on that iron pipeline, on getting it clogged at the federal level.
So, Jackie, you've been out in the streets now for years demonstrating against Trump. With any luck, fingers crossed, he's going to be out of office in a few weeks. First of all, I am worried about next week and the whole Senate thing on the 6th. I'm also worried about the Georgia election on the 5th. But where do you go after January 20th? We've identified a lot of issues that are continuing, but does Rise and Resist have plans? Or what's the
I think we're going to be getting involved with, you know, Tax the Rich. Michael Kink has his organization. My mind is a blank now. People for Strong, the name of his organization. But trying to see what's going on in terms of that.
Are you going to miss this focus on Trump? Are you going to feel lost? Or do you feel you can,
I don't know that he's going away that quickly. You know, I mean, not that we're going to focus on him, but he's going to be around. And the effect of what he's doing is going to be around. He's got 70-odd million people that are still devoted to him. And that's dangerous. You know, I don't know what platform he's going to use. I don't know how we have to try to anticipate or see what's happening there. You know, that's a huge chunk of people that can be incredibly destructive. So on the one hand, you know, we're ready to deal with whatever we have to do and be very outside and very vocal about it. Right now, we're also very concerned with COVID, and we can't drop the focus on that in terms of people behind bars who are, you know, being mistreated and are in great danger, and many of whom should be released. You know, there's a whole debate about vaccination. You know, and who is on the list of priorities of who's getting them. In terms of, you know, phase one, phase two, whatever. I mean, you know, the prison guards are all lined up to get their vaccinations, but not the prisoners, not the people who are prisoners. I don't like to just call them, you know, people who are in prison. They are, you know, not being looked after, and this is a tremendous problem. Immigration, you know, in terms of, you know, people in camps, and these people are still, you know, locked up in cages, wherever. They're all in great. That's a lot of our focus right now still. in terms of, you know, trying to protect people and shine a light on people who are still being, you know, who are devastated.
And I have to say, Jack, in order to address a lot of these problems, you have to know what the stats are. And the states and the cities, even though they have laws about it, have not given us good statistics on how COVID is affecting the LGBTQ community or people with HIV. And, you know, the census is under attack. We don't even know what kind of how we're going to be counted in the census, or if you know, all kinds of people are going to be counted in the census. I mean, Jillian, are there legal things that can be done to get these counts in and up, especially when there are laws saying we should have them?
Well, you know, I guess the question is, you know, what is the effect going to be of Trump judges and as Jackie mentioned, the 70 odd million people who support that in various places around the state, the states? You know, will we be able to do these things if there continues to be such opposition, even though the majority of people are saying that we should? That's my concern is, you know, do we have the legislatures? Do we have the judges? Do we have all of the players that we need to do what we need to do? And it's not clear to me.
Well, and I would say not yet. And we may backslide in 2 years. We may lose more legislatures. We may lose the House in 2 years. We cannot afford to get complacent about any of this.
They put a gay man in charge of trying to hold the Democrats for the House. We're down to our last 6 minutes. What are you most hopeful about, folks?
Too much he's trying. Andy's trying to get positivity in there.
Really, what are you most hopeful about?
I'm going to say that I'm really hopeful that the vaccines are going to get distributed widely, accepted, and that the reticence that some people in some communities have early on is going to fade away. We've already started seeing numbers along those lines. So I'm hopeful for a successful vaccination rollout and a return to something approaching normalcy by the summer, by late June, in time for the third annual Queer Liberation March.
Jackie, what are you hopeful for?
I don't know if it's hopeful, but I'm more grateful, and in there's hope that I don't have to see Trump on the news 24/7 like we have for the last year. I mean, is there anything worse than that for the last 4 years? The fact that he's, you know, left the White House and may not come back at all. I mean, he's in Florida, and hopefully he'll stay there until they throw him out, and then who knows where he'll go. But the fact that I don't have to turn on, because I do have the news on in the background right this minute, and most of the time, unfortunately, even though I swear it off every other day, it's MSNBC is right behind me right now, and there's no sign of Trump, you know, although what was that airplane? Maybe. And so the fact that that's not going to, that I don't have to wake up with him as president, is such a hopeful level of relief, you know, that I can breathe again. I don't think I've breathed for 4 years. Or I wake up in such a bad mood. I wake up, and the minute after I wake up, I go, I'm in such a bad mood. I tense up. And right now, I mean, I'm finally beginning to breathe and not be that tense. So I'm hopeful that I'll have a healthier life. They will all be a lot healthier as a result of that.
Gillian?
I echo both of those sentiments. And also I'm hopeful that the levels of discrimination and discriminatory language and prejudice and bias that's been unleashed in the country by all of these right-wing elements encouraged by, you know, the leaders that have been put in place will diminish, and that we will see a lot less of that bias floating around, and that, you know, our community will prosper.
Let's put bigotry back in the closet.
Yes.
I think I will have many arguments with the Biden administration. I'm not expecting nirvana But I am really, really looking forward to a different set of values in the White House and the administration. Nor do I think politicians are the be-all and end-all for anything, but I'm looking forward to humane leaders who will assert a set of values that is 180 degrees different from what we've been living through for the last 4 years. And I yearn for that return to that kind of inspiration and those values.
Right. And, you know, the United States isn't the be-all, end-all either. And we're a troubled country at this point. But we get to report every week about wonderful things that are happening in the far corners of the globe, even Antarctica. Seriously, I mean, to see these activists, you want to talk about bravery, you know, stepping out in Uganda and Russia and all these places, stepping out to have pride marches, demonstrations, and getting things passed and getting good court decisions in Russia and places like that. And that's fantastic. That means our message is getting around the world and is blossoming.
Yeah, I don't like to give the United States much credit for anything, but I do think that our communities have been leaders in this movement around the world and have created this ripple effect. So it is exciting to me on a daily basis to see the kind of thing that Andy just described.
It is interesting that when the government fails in its responsibility to represent the country effectively on the global stage, that the people can step into that gap. And
it's always about the people.
Ideals.
Always yeah. about the people.
No more Mike Pompeo.
Yay!
don't get too optimistic. He's going to run for office. We're going to have to see a lot more Mike Pompeo. He may not succeed. All right. So, all right. Well, we should thank our guests who have been enormously generous in sharing their time and their thoughts with us. J.W. Walker of many groups, Rise and Resist, the RBG, Ruth Bader Ginsburg Army, Gays Against Guns, Reclaim Pride. Jackie Rudin, also similarly a veteran activist and co-founder of all of these groups. And Jillian Weiss, a terrific, brilliant lawyer who has brought us many wins in court cases and in thinking about trans rights over the years. And we're thrilled to have all of them.
If you get our emails, if you sign up for our email list at gayusatv.org, we will send you links to all of their organizations and to Jillian's new textbook, which is called Gender Identity and the Law, written with Professor David Cruz of USC Law School.
I think these annual dates are artificial divisions. Nonetheless, we feel we're wrapping up. We hope we're wrapping up and throwing away a horrible year.
We're out. And thank
horrible
you all.
4 years.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
Here's to leaders who can speak in full sentences.